I hear the voice of my grandmother calling me. I hear the voice of my grandmother calling. Wake up, wake up. She says, wake up, wake up. Listen, listen. Listen, listen. May the rivers all run free. May the mountains be unspoiled. May the air be pure. May the trees grow up tall. May the earth be shared by all. I hear the voice of my grandmother calling me. I hear the voice of my grandmother calling. Wake up, wake up. She says, wake up, wake up. Listen, listen. Listen, listen. May the rivers all run free. May the mountains be unspoiled. May the air be pure. May the trees grow up tall. May the earth be shared by all. May the air be pure. May the trees grow up tall. May the earth be shared by all.
Hello and welcome to the Womb Centered Healing Podcast. Before we get started with this episode, I'd like to share with you a few announcements about what's going on in the Womb Centered Healing Temple, which is an online space for womb-centered healing practitioners to collaborate and share the important work of womb-centered healing with the world. I'm Sama Morningstar, the founder of the Womb-Centered Healing Temple, and I'd like to invite you to visit the Womb-Centered Healing Temple website at wombcenteredhealing.com. And there you can sign up to receive the Womb-Centered Healing Temple newsletter, which will send you an email notification every time there's a new podcast episode out. And you'll also receive notifications about blog posts. And you'll also be notified when there's new events, courses, and things to look forward to. You can explore the website there and see a variety of online courses that are available to support your womb-centered healing journey. So I hope to see you there, signing up for the newsletter and perhaps for some courses and events. And otherwise, until then, enjoy this episode. Hello and welcome to the Womb Centered Healing Podcast. I'm Sama Morningstar and I have Brian with me here today. Brian was introduced to me by a previous podcast guest as I was inviting folks to come on the show and talk about the elements. Some people talk about the four elements, some people talk about the five elements. And womb-centered healing, womb wellness. And Brian is an acupuncturist and Chinese medicine practitioner and volunteered to come on the show and talk about the five elements in womb wellness. So Brian, please introduce yourself some more and share about your relationship with womb-centered healing, womb wellness, and some of your initial reflections on this topic.
Absolutely. Thank you, Samuel. My name is Brian Mears. I'm an acupuncturist in Denver, Colorado. I've got a private practice up in Westminster, actually. I've been doing this for 14 years. I have a master's degree in Oriental medicine. About 80% of my clientele happens to be women, and not all of them are coming to me to work with a womb-centered wellness, but it almost always comes up as a topic of conversation somewhere along the line through their healing journeys. Within my own journey, if we're looking at womb, obviously I have a Y chromosome, so I don't technically have those organs, but we're looking at the Hara or the Dantian, Hara being Japanese, Dantian being Chinese as far as the naming. And that's the lower abdomen, and that's really the root, the center of our chi, our energy centers. The cultivation of yin happens in that area. And so within my own healing journey, it's been really finding my foundation, finding the space that then I can build creatively off of, both as a practitioner, as a dad of three kiddos, as an artist, plus all the other hats that I wear throughout throughout my daily life. I actually do a daily Qigong to be able to strengthen the lower abdomen and strengthen that energy center, to be able to work on the nutritive, the yin aspect of what it is to be a human, so that the yang aspect, that is the functionality, then has something to be able to act against.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So could you share a little bit about your personal initial discovery of the importance of this yin aspect? Because, you know, it sounds like you were probably born and raised here in the United States, and most men who have had that experience that I've met don't necessarily understand the importance of the yin aspect of their personality, of their body, of that nutritive, self-nourishing, creative center. What woke you up to that? Or did you have influences in your early childhood that let you know that this was an important part of your life to tend to?
Early childhood, not so much. As far as sort of standard American childhood in that piece, did have a couple of fairly traumatic events that happened late teenage years, which really threw me into a path of looking at Eastern philosophies. And as part of Eastern philosophies, then we're looking at yin and yang, the nutritive pieces of it. And then trials and tribulations eventually led me into Chinese medical school, which was really a big piece of trying to find and cultivate that center. About seven years ago, I actually was exposed to a fairly healthy dose of black mold, which nearly took me out. And the only way I got through that was really working on the nutritive aspect, working on the structure as we're clearing out the toxins, copious amounts of meditation, lots of keloid therapy for the physical piece of it, but really it was the internal story that needed to be able to change, so that we could work on that that holding space that I needed, both physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually, to be able to process through those hardships and be able to continue forward as a dad, as a practitioner, and all the other hats that I wear.
Uh-huh. So there was quite a psychological, emotional, spiritual healing, it sounds like, that needed to happen, changing some belief systems and some internal storylines around that healing process, that the mold exposure and the detrimental health effects of that brought up for you. And I know we talked about before we started the recording that tends to be a big focus of yours, is the psychological, spiritual, emotional healing side of things. And I'm really curious about, because I mean, mold, if we think about mold, there's some elemental influences in mold. Okay. So mold occurs where there's dampness, where there's too much water, not enough fire, and that's where mold can start to, you know, take hold and start to degrade structural things. Like if you're thinking about a house, like the wood in the house starts to get a fungal infection, and then you know, other pests can more easily come in, like carpenter ants, I'm thinking, and, you know, and pretty soon the walls are crumbling down, right? And so it can eventually take out a house. Whereas in the human body, a similar kind of thing is the case. And it all starts from an imbalance in the element of water. And that will affect different organs in the body that have to do with that element. And I'm curious if you can describe, and then that also affects like the flow of our emotions and our thoughts, and our belief systems may be affected by that imbalance in water, but they may also be at the origin of that imbalance of water, of how the water flows through our body or not. If it's being held back or held in one area and not flowing into another area. and how our organs are functioning can be affected by our psychology and our belief systems and our spiritual well-being or lack of well-being. And so can you share a little bit about that and this relationship to water that I'm assuming it was happening with the mold incident?
Absolutely. I mean, mold is, you got a portion of that. So we've got the dampness piece of it, the water aspect. There's also a heat aspect. Mold doesn't grow in cold environments. So you've got,
yes,
right. So you've got this dampness and then the heat piece of it. So sort of swamp-esque conditions that are in there.
Wow. Yes.
Right.
Swampy. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, I mean, mold is a decomposer and it's breaking down that which no longer serves a purpose. So on an emotional level, it was breaking through all of the fears, breaking through all of the old stories, the frustrations, the anger, all of those pieces that I had built up over the years and really needing to embrace the aspect of being able to receive. I'd always been a giver, still am, but the challenge has always been in the receiving piece of life. If we're looking at the five elements, let me give a real quick just on the five elements. So we've got five main elements within Chinese medicine. We start off with fire, and then we're going to earth, water. Fire, I'm trying to do it backwards so it's correct on the camera. Fire, earth, metal, water, and then wood are the five elements that we have. And so you end up with fire ends up building earth. Earth compresses metal. Metal nourishes water. Water nourishes wood again, and the wood will feed fire. And so you have this cycle where we're generating cycle. You also have a controlling cycle that goes with that, where you end up with a fire where temper metal. Metal will chop wood. Wood penetrates through earth. Earth dams up water. Water will extinguish fire. So you have a controlling aspect as well. Mm-hmm. Within my own experience, it was mostly wood and water that were out of balance. Now, the element of wood has to do, let me back up. We've got hollow organs and solid organs, the Zong Fu within Chinese medicine. And each element has two organs that go with it. And so the element of wood has the liver and the gallbladder that go with that. And of course, they're paired physically within the body from a Western biomechanical sense. And if we look at the way that the liver and its branching out through the lymphatic system and removal of all the toxins, it makes a lot of sense that liver would have this image of wood that would be a piece of that. Mm-hmm. Kidneys end up with the element of water, and you have kidneys and urinary bladder, and those, of course, are almost as closely linked as the liver and gallbladder happen to be. Mm-hmm. Now, the emotions that go on top of both of those, kidneys end up with fear and liver ends up with anger and frustration. Mm-hmm. So within our culture, we have this idea of like an angry drunk. The drunk doesn't get angry because the alcohol. The alcohol removes the inhibition and therefore the anger that's already there can pour out. Mm-hmm. Right. Fear on the kidneys. Kidneys have the adrenal glands that sit on top of them like a little hat. And so anytime that we experience fear, either from life-threatening stress or lifestyle stress, the adrenal glands will release. And so if we have a hat that's physically on fire, we can't do our job. So fear ends up controlling the kidneys and can weaken them. Mm-hmm. So looking at during that time period with the black mold, my third child had just been born. We were having financial difficulties. There's frustration just being an acupuncturist in general, because it's something that Western the populace was not embracing quite as much then as it is now. And there's a lot of fear about, I got to be able to pay the bills, and how am I going to have time for myself, and how am I going to be a good dad and a good husband, and all of those other pieces that were part of that equation during that portion of my life. So when the liver becomes stagnant, it builds up dampness, and it will create heat, friction aspect. And then water, when that becomes stagnant, is dampness. And so we had this perfect environment inside of me that ended up creating a damp heat. The third organ system that was involved actually was the earth elements, and that's spleen and stomach. I think spleen is actually a mistranslation in the ancient text. It really seems like pancreas is more appropriate. The reason why is they talk about the spleen being under the fire underneath the cauldron that is the stomach. So we're cooking the foods that goes into the stomach, which is not really the spleen's functionality. It's more of a pancreatic function. And of course, that's going in the small intestine. But if we're looking at sort of the organ systems immediately underneath the diaphragm, liver, gallbladder, stomach, spleen, pancreas, it makes sense in that space. So when the spleen isn't getting what it needs, dampness can occur, when the liver becomes frustrated and angry, then you can have heat that shows up in that space. And then, fear is the grand domino tipper that can knock all of us off of our midline very quickly.
Mm-hmm. So all of these things that you're describing sound very similar to what one might address if, for example, a woman came in with menstrual difficulties or fertility difficulties. That whole system of stagnation in the liver, stagnation in the kidneys, the whole where the fires aren't cooking the food properly, so lack of nourishment coming, you can end up with that liver stagnation and the kidney stagnation not allowing enough blood flow and fluid flow to the womb and in the womb. So then you have menstrual stagnation, womb stagnation, and then the not cooking the food enough, not digesting the food enough. You end up having blood deficiency, not enough nutrients in the blood to be able to be menstruating every month in a way that's healthy. And then you have blood, anemia, blood deficiency, all of these things. And then the body responds in various ways, depending on how much inflammation, how much heat there is. It might go in one direction, or how much not enough heat there is, it can go in another direction. And so can you share a little bit more about the stagnation part? Like, there seems to be like, which comes first, the chicken or the egg? The stagnation creating the emotional stagnation, or the emotional stagnation creating the organ stagnation, or what, can you share about that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's all a chicken when it comes down to it, right? Whether it's in an egg form or it's in a chicken form, right. you can have one that creates the other. For clarification, the kidneys do not actually get stagnant, they get deficient. So the liver can become stagnant, the spleen can become stagnant, become encumbered with dampness. But the kidneys are really the guards of what they call the Mingmen fire, which is sort of the pilot light that keeps us running. Mm-hmm. And when we run out of fuel, it's game over for us. Mm-hmm. We each burn a little bit off of that Mingmen fire every single day to get us up and get us moving. Women use a whole bunch of that to be able to, with gestation, because it takes a lot of energy to make an extra organ to be able to support an extra human. And there, people that use experience-altering drugs will release a lot of that Mingmen fire, which can very quickly deplete the kidney energy, which is why somebody who's done meth for like a month will look 5 years older in a very short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as the emotional pieces of that, we do live in a very frustrating time. Most Americans are walking around with something in between their liver and their spleen as far as the diagnosis. We've got frustration on one side, spleen ends up with pensiveness, worry, and overthinking. And so it's not just digesting the physical food, but it's digesting the world around us, even outside of the last 13 months. With all the stories that we've been exposed to, there's still this digesting of relationships and what we're wanting in life and all of those other components. That just goes in with being a modern human in general.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have the propensity to overthink, that can certainly encumber the digestive system, because we're trying to digest something that really we should have seen, acknowledged, processed, and let go. And let it go from the spleen stomach complex down into the small intestine so we can absorb the nutrients out of it. Small intestine is responsible for sorting the pure from the impure. We know that both from Western and Eastern medicines. And then once it's been absorbed, then it goes to the heart to then be distributed throughout the entire body as far as with the blood and the heart piece. Heart ends up being fire, and it's actually the heart and the small intestine are paired for that reason, because it's absorption of the nutrients and then spreading of the fire, spreading of the blood throughout the entire body.
Mm.
The last organs that we've mentioned, all the other ones happens to be metal. That's actually lung and large intestine. That ends up with depression, melancholy, and sadness. And so if somebody has one of those emotions, certainly physically their lungs can become weak. They can end up with GI issues as far as large intestine. And if somebody has constipation, diarrhea, that's right there in that same area as far as the womb. And that can cause stagnation just of healthy circulation of blood in that area. So we're not getting good nutrients down into the fetal palace, which is actually how the literal translation of uterus from Chinese to English.
Mm-hmm. I've also heard the description of the womb being called the Sea of Blood. Have you heard that one before?
Sea of Blood is the Chongmai. So we've got the 12 main vessels that we can see on the Chinese mannequin with the lines and the dots. Mm-hmm. And then you have 8 extra vessels. And these are actually come from shortly after conception from the third division of the egg once it's been fertilized. You've got 8 different lines. You've got 8 different cells and you can have the lines that are going around. I'm sorry. Yes, 8 different cells that can be going around that. And so Chongmai is one of those specific ones. It's running down the middle of the body. If you're going to look at a physical structure, it's really the descending aorta. Mm-hmm. Certainly feeding from the heart down into the lower aspects, getting into the kidneys, supplying nutrients down there into everything that we have within the pelvic floor. And it's where all the blood is circulating through. When we're looking at female health specifically, the Chongmai and the conception vessel are the two main 8 extra vessels that we work the most with. Conception vessel actually starts in between the root of the genitals and the anus, runs up the midline and ends right at the lower level of the mouth. And so we've got this front aspect, both internal with the Chongmai and then external with the conception vessel. Those both have to be open in order for female health or just womb wellness in general to be able to happen. The other two that come into play is the governing vessel, which runs up the backside and ends on the top lip of the mouth. And then the Daimai, which actually ends up encircling us like a belt. The other four are mirrored of those and are more complicated than we need to get into.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's not just female bodies that have these vessels, right?
Correct.
So on other gendered bodies with different biology, they're gonna still be nourishing and involved in the functioning of the genital organs perhaps. And there's a sea of blood. Everyone has an aorta that runs down. Right. So,
yep.
So the hara and the energy center that we talked about that we are associating with the womb, the uterus, the physical uterus, that energy center is there for everyone of all genders. Can you talk about the difference between these vessels, these channels that you're talking about in relationship with a physical uterus versus in relationship to a different biological gendered person?
Absolutely. So the Chongmai and the conception vessel are more yin in nature, whereas the Daimai and the governing vessel are more yang in nature. Mm-hmm. A female biological body tends to be more yin. We need that structure. It takes a lot of foundation to be able to have the strength to be able to create life and hold, not only have a regular monthly cycle, but be able to have the womb have child. Mm-hmm. And be able to hold that pregnancy all the way to term. Men tend to be more yang in nature. Men, biological male bodies tend to be more yang in nature. And that's where we're ending up with the two biological genders and their interaction in that space. So as far as somebody that is carrying a Y chromosome, the Chongmai certainly still goes down through the pelvis and working with all of those energies. But men are not as interested, as far as the bodies are not as interested in nourishing that area. We still need blood circulation into the genitals. But a lot of the Chongmai goes into making denser muscles. It goes into the structural differences that we see in between male bodies and female bodies.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of, there's a continuum of gender, really. Some female organ, female gendered people may very well have quite dense musculature and have, Absolutely. More of a masculine looking body, and some male gendered bodies might have less of that. And that's just going to be an individual placement on the continuum of gender. That might be reflected in this balance between these yin and yang channels that you're talking about. So I'm curious, Can you share about, like, you talked about all the different organs and which elements they were associated with the in this system of the five elements, but you didn't mention the womb there and these channels. So is that because these are extra channels besides these five central ones that you talked about, or?
Those are considered extra organs. And so we have the extraordinary organs and the extraordinary vessels. And they fall, the main five element theory is based on just keeping the body going. It's the main organs that every human has. It doesn't get into the specifics. I didn't mention the brain either. The brain's actually considered a extension of the kidneys, and it's considered the curious organ in the bony box and has no functionality within Chinese medicine other than the acknowledgement of its existence. It's not part of their medical diagnosis, which seems very strange as a Westerner. conversations about biological female bodies, as we're looking at the uterus, that is a conversation with the Chong Mai, which is probably where you ended up hearing the sea of blood connection there. And just as you have yin within yang and everything is intertransformational, to your point of that, you've got the full spectrum of people's experiences of yin versus yang. We have that same space ends up happening as far as with some people will be more yang regardless of biological gender. Some people will be more yin regardless of biological gender. But the uterus, really, we're looking at the eight extra organs or extra vessels being mostly the conception vessel and the Chong Mai to be able to work with uterine health.
And are those vessels associated with the elements in any particular way?
They're a subcategory. They're going all the way back to basically before mom knew that she was pregnant with us, which is why they're eight extras.
I see. So they really were formed in those first few cell divisions, like you were talking about. Almost some from like the primordial goo that we all come from before it's even divided into the different elements.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it's essential chi, essence chi, right? It doesn't go into the normal flow of how we're looking at chi movement through the body. This is going all the way. This is the deep rooted stuff, right? By the time you've done a third division of a cell, we shouldn't have any mutations. We shouldn't have anything wrong with that organ system. Mm-hmm. On a theoretical basis. By the time you get to a full-size human, we've got trillions of cells. You can have a couple cells that have had mutation problems, and that's where some of the disharmonies can show up in the larger organ systems.
So my understanding of that essential chi is that we are born with sort of a bank account of that. And I've heard it called jing. Am I talking about the same thing?
You're correct. So when we have conception, we've got half from mom, half from dad. We know that as genetics from a Western perspective. That gets stored in the left kidney. The first 7 to 8 years of life, we end up, how we're nourished ends up filling up the right kidney. So this is not just the food that we eat, but how are we loved, the lessons that we learn, did we have trauma, all of those pieces. Those two then combine over the next 7 to 8 years. And that becomes the fuel that we end up running off of for the rest of our life. And that fuel is what is the pilot light that Ming Min hooks into that keeps us going on a daily basis. Mm-hmm.
And so that we inherit that bank account once our kidneys actually form.
Correct.
But if we're talking about the essential energy that is happening in those initial cell divisions before any organs are formed, I'm imagining that essential energy is starting to come in, or it is there, and that it just finds a location to reside once we have the kidney form.
At that point, we're all jing, right? There is no definition.
All jing, right? It's all jing. Okay.
If we're looking at from a Taoist perspective, which is what the five elements is really based off of, the Tao, which can be named, is not the Tao. So we have sort of the empty set. Yeah. We have the first division. That's where you end up with the black and white swirls. Yeah. Your second division is where you end up with the opposite color dots on those. And that from there, you end up with the myriad of 10,000 things. Yeah. So right? Once we have conception, then we're in that space before we've had all of these extra divisions, and we go from primordial soup into human form.
Gotcha. So we're all Jing, and then we start to make all those 10,000 things. And once we get a kidney, a left kidney, our bank account of Jing takes up residence there, gets a safety deposit box.
Yes.
Gives the, maybe the key to that safety deposit box is somewhere, who knows, but we have access to it. And you mentioned earlier, you know, how that fuel can get depleted. You mentioned people taking drugs like methamphetamine, that can really deplete the fuel very quickly. Mm-hmm. From my understanding, any kind of stimulant, even something as common as coffee, can be very depleting for that Jing energy. And even our lifestyle and the degrees of stress. Well, first of all, early childhood trauma, if we're not being nourished in a way that's filling up the right kidney, like you talked about, then, and I can imagine that breastfeeding would be, a healthy breastfeeding journey where we're really getting that digestive tract development and the, you know, customized nutrition from a healthy mother's body that naturally, you know, delivers that and develops our ability to receive that nourishment. If that's disrupted, which it has been for many generations now, then that also like has us starting off in those first years of life with less fuel. Right. And then depletion on top of that of the bank account we inherited. And I'm curious what you feel about that bank account that we inherited. It seems like if our parents are depleted because they also didn't receive all the nourishment and they also were under stress to begin with in those first moments after conception, when those first divisions and how much Jing their parents had available even to feed into that. Does it take a Jing from the parents to conceive a child? Is that where that's coming from? Or is it coming from some other mysterious place?
No, Jing is the egg for women and sperm for men. Cell systems are made out of Jing themselves.
So
depending upon the state of the parent.
That Jing comes from the bank account of the parent. So every time a woman ovulates, a little bit of Jing is going in from her bank account is going into that egg.
Correct. Hold on just a moment. My dog's losing his mind on something outside.
Okay, hold
Sorry.
On. Okay, so a little bit of Jing goes into every egg that someone ovulates, and whether it's released or is inseminated and becomes a child, or any variation of that could take more Jing. Is the mother's body feeding that more Jing into that growing being?
Well, that's the creation of the placenta. The creation of the placenta is coming from Jing. Uh-huh. Right, and then supported by the other organ systems through the sea of blood to be able to actually make a sustainable space within the uterus for the fetus to grow.
So every child that a mother gestates and brings to term or gestates for part of the way is a huge investment of Jing.
Yeah.
And I'm imagining that there are ways to replenish that Jing. Are there ways to replenish the Jing in the left kidney, or is that once it's spent, it's gone and you just have to work with the right kidney then?
They combine. So once we're adults and we're actually able to be sexually productive, then we don't have, it's not right versus left. It's coming from the, okay. You can't replace Jing. It's just you use it and it's gone, unfortunately. The way that you can support that is you support the kidneys, because the body will pull off of the kidney energy as part of pulling off of the Jing. And so if we have strong kidney energy, then we're able to, women are better able to support with gestation, and we're just in general able to be better humans. And actually a large portion of the aging process is the kidney energy becoming lower and lower. You mentioned caffeine as being detrimental. And of course, caffeine works by physically stressing out the body. And that goes back to what I said earlier about the body stressed. We release cortisol through the adrenal glands. And then that puts us into the state of stress. Kidneys can't function. They don't have what they need. And so that we burn off a little bit of extra kidney energy during that space as well.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a difference then between a male-bodied person's contribution to, you know, offering a package of yep. plenty of sperm. I mean, with one ejaculation, there's lots of little sperms. Like, right. you know, women ovulate once a month, maybe more than one egg, but yep. it's not the hundreds of thousands of sperms. and this is why in the Taoist traditions around male sexuality, the importance of retaining ejaculation and retaining that sperm in the body became really important, to retain that Jing energy and not be depleting that a lot.
Correct.
And that comes from this same thing that we're talking about, is that each little package of Jing is, once it's gone, it's gone, and there's no getting it back. Is that right?
Correct. Now, women, of course, aren't making an egg every single month. They're just releasing it from the ovaries. They have all of those by the time they're born. So that's, you know, those are the coins in the safety deposit box. And so they're pulling one of those out every single time, whereas men are using energy to be able to create the sperm on the fly, rather than having, you know, pulling one egg out at a time.
And so are they then, depending on their, you know, practices around that, are men expending more Jing energy just in the production? If we just look at the production of sperm and the production of eggs, I mean, men are producing a lot more sperm than they are eggs.
They are, but they're much smaller and they're much easier to create than an egg is, because the egg is not just a data packet, right? It's not just DNA with a tail, right? You've got all of the little organelle systems within there. You've got the mitochondria, and of course the mitochondrial DNA is passed from mom to child. That has nothing to do with that whatsoever. And women are using some piece of Jing to be able to menstruate on a regular basis, because that's part of the internal programming on just having a female body and menstruating.
So it kind of evens out in the end, that even though the men are producing a lot more sperm than women are producing eggs, women are menstruating and perhaps even gestating and giving birth to and breastfeeding a child, which is another big withdrawal, deposit of Jing into this child. So it kind of seems like, as far as Jing expenditure for reproduction, does it even out kind of, or what would you think about
that? It sort of does. The ancient texts say that men age on a series of 7 years. And so I mentioned 7 or 8 years as far as that initial cultivation of how we're nourished. Mm-hmm. And so men are every 7 years, so 7, 14, 21, and so on. Women are every 8 years, so they go just a little bit slower, but that's also why women typically live longer than men do.
Mm-hmm. So it doesn't get as depleted, although women who have lots of babies, it seems like that might change.
Absolutely. It absolutely, I mean, it's physically difficult on the body, and energetically it's a lot to be able to create an organ to be able to support a life. And then if they choose to breastfeed, then going through that entire portion of the journey as well.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get back to how emotional and spiritual imbalances can be affecting this, not only the Jing, but also the way that the elements are nourishing these organ systems that keep us alive, and therefore, and also these these essential organ systems with the womb and all of that, that it seems like emotional patterns that we have around emotions, especially the ones like anger and frustration and grief and sadness, where there's such a societal forbiddance around fully feeling these emotions that aren't socially acceptable, that there's not really any healthy training in our upbringing about how to deal with anger, unless maybe you watched Mr. Rogers, but he had to fight really hard to like be able to offer what he did. But most families, and I mean, I'm sure there are some families that had some kind of emotional awareness and wisdom, but certainly not the family I grew up in. And so a lot of people for quite a few generations have been raised under very emotionally suppressive way of life, where it wasn't okay to have emotions. It wasn't okay to share your emotions, to express or even feel your emotions. So that suppression of all of these emotions feels like the underlying cause of a lot of this stagnation that we were talking about, where, and I associate emotions with water and maybe it's the same, but some are associated with fire, but in general, feeling and expressing our emotions feels like the flow of water, like allowing that to flow, and suppressing that creates this stagnation. And if they're fiery, hot water emotions, then that contributes to that moldy, damp condition, right? Hot, moldy swamp.
Yep.
And so I'm curious how you help people start to develop wiser, healthier approaches to emotions to unstick that stagnation that we get so indoctrinated with, and be able to have our blood flow more freely, because it really does affect the flow of our menstrual blood. It affects the flow of nutrients to all of our organs, whether we're menstruating or not. Because it's like the chicken and the egg, right? If the organs are all stagnant, our emotions are all stagnant, how do we unstick that?
You know, that's a national dialogue that I think needs to be had on at some point in time. As the individual, the way that I'm doing it, at least within my clinic, is people come in with whatever, fill in the blank, and then we start looking at, and Chinese medicine looks at the entire system. It's not just shoulder pain or dysregulation of the menses or any of those bits and pieces. It's what's the full picture. And sort of mixing in, it's not Louise Hay and her breadth of knowledge as far as the messages from the body, but it's mixing that idea with the Chinese medical understanding of what all the organ systems do. And that creates a dialogue that says, for example, a lot of people I've seen lately have had shoulder pain, particularly along the scapula. The scapula in Chinese medicine is ruled by the small intestine as far as the vessel system that you see zigzagging across that on the mannequins. And yes, I know the scapula and the small intestine are physically nowhere close to the body, or close to each other within the body. But the shoulder is all about change and flexibility. It's the most flexible joint in the human body with the greatest range of motion. And if we have the ability to sort the pure from the impure, as far as from a small intestine perspective, then we have flexibility. This is good for me. This is nutrients. This is what I need. This is waste material. I'm going to let this go. And so people that frequently have something with their GI almost always end up with something with their shoulder, particularly there along the rotator cuff, all ruled by the small intestine. So the emotions are stuck within that space, and they need to be able to work through that, finding their own flexibility. Making that connection then at least gives them a foundation to begin to start working on whatever other emotional expressions they need to have. Mm-hmm. Within women, the liver ends up being a very large component because it is the organ that governs the blood. And if the liver becomes frustrated, it will lock down. And then we have blood not being purified. And of course, we want purified, clean blood to be going into the uterus into the fetal palate so that if there is conception, that we've got a healthy place for the fetus to grow. Things like dysmenorrhea, blood clots, heavy bleeding, and even light bleeding, all of those can, or scanty bleeding, all of those can actually come from a liver dysfunction. Not necessarily physical liver organ, but the emotional piece of frustration and anger that's stuck with the body.
And I imagine that, I mean, I've seen it myself, but I imagine that you've seen it with the clientele that you've had, because female anger is one of the biggest forbiddances in our society. I mean, it's just not okay for women to be angry. And an angry woman is supposed to be an insult.
Right.
Right. It's just not okay for a woman to be angry in most societal circles. And, whereas for men, anger is pretty much the only emotion that's okay for a man to have.
Right.
And experience and express in these patterns that we're talking about, societal patterns. And so how do you help women to start to get in touch with and accept and have a healthy relationship with the natural emotion of anger? I mean, I talk a lot about it because in my experience, it wasn't okay for me to be angry. It wasn't safe for me to be angry, because if I felt and expressed any of my anger as a young girl, that would inflame the anger of my dad. It was just wasn't okay for me to be angry, and it wasn't safe for my dad to be angry at me.
Right.
And sure, I'm not the only one to have this experience. And so for my own survival, I suppressed my anger so deep I didn't think I ever did get angry. And it took me quite a while to unstick that stagnation, to let that come out and recognize the healthy aspects of anger that is part of the functionality of the liver that says, this stuff in the blood is not okay to have in the blood, and I'm going to sort that out and filter that out and convert that to a useful substance. Because my understanding, the liver takes the toxins from the blood and converts it into bile, which becomes a useful substance to help with the process of digesting the richness of the fats and the proteins that we're eating. And so that's exactly what anger does for us, right? It says, whoa, this is not okay. And it gives us the energy to express to somebody or some situation, this is not okay. This is what's not okay about it. Let's make a change, because it's not okay for this to carry on the way that it is. And if we suppress that, then we're going around letting not okay things carry on happening in our lives. And so I'm curious how you find it is most helpful with some of your patients to come to terms with, oh, I really do need to, be aware of and work with this natural anger.
No, you already hit the nail on the head as far as it's giving themselves permission, mm-hmm. right? Anger can be a very motivating emotion, but it needs to be focused on the direction that we need it to go in and not have it spill out in a very toxic manner. Right. If there's a lot of latent anger that's been very deep underneath a lot of different layers, then I usually recommend a letter writing campaign, right? Dear mom, F you, I can't believe you, whatever. We're not delivering that. We're going to have a burning bowl ceremony safely in the backyard, and we're going to read it out loud, and then we're going to let it go, right? And frequently we have to do that lots of times before we're finally able to get down and actually process through all of this. But it's giving ourselves permission to express those emotions and experience those emotions. And just like grief, anybody that's lost a loved one, grief will come in waves, and you'll be doing great. All of a sudden you'll get triggered about a memory. And if we try to suppress that, then it becomes even harder for us to actually work through the grief versus I'm going to give myself permission to excuse myself for the next half an hour. I'm going to experience what I need to go through. I'm going to cry. I'm going to, you know, scream into a pillow, whatever I need to do to be able to let that emotion go. And then we're going to take a moment, recenter ourselves, and get back to what I was doing before I was triggered in that space.
Mm-hmm. And sounds like you're speaking from your own personal experience of realizing that you needed to process your emotions too. So that it sounds like that's going to be the most supportive way to come at it from a practitioner's perspective. Because if you weren't able to do those things that you just described, or you hadn't, you wouldn't really be able to impart that to your clients.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, most of the baby boomers didn't get the message of how to express what was going on, right? We're going to have on our Sunday best. Everything's hunky-dory. We don't talk about abuse, alcoholism, you know, money problems, whatever's going on behind closed doors. We're just going to say that everything's fine, keeping up with the Joneses. It's all great. And then you end up with folks in my generation and parents doing the absolute best that they could, but they didn't have the emotional tools to be able to say, let's express the anger, let's express the fear, let's express the sadness, because they hadn't learned that in their own childhood. And so part of my own journey was figuring that out.
Did you have through the Chinese medicine is what helped you figure that out. And did you have some mentors in your training or courses that actually spelled it out, that these are healthy emotional processing methods that you can use for yourself? And, or did you have to like combine different therapies in there?
There is a subset of the acupuncture world, which is specifically five elements. And it is very heavily focused on psychology all by itself. Uh-huh. I did have a class in that, which I think was emotions 101, right? It got through a little piece of it. I didn't really resonate well with that subsection of the medicine because I wanted to see the rest of the picture.
Yeah.
And so then it's been trials and tribulations, my own hardships that I've gone through, and then assisting patients as they're going through their things, that really just trial and error and experience put everything together for me.
Uh-huh. So you started to implement some of the things you learned in that course for your own healing process, your own process of coping with whatever was going on. Did you have mentors along the way to support you with that process besides your teachers from original training?
No, I've kind of done it all on my own, just because I'm stubborn that way. Uh-huh. You know, read Louise Hay's book, and that really resonated, not for her message, but the aha moment of there's a whole language within Chinese medicine and the organs and their emotions. And then now the vessel systems, as far as what does knee pain mean? What does ankle pain mean? What does, you know, all these different, the myriad of 10,000 symptoms that we can have with the disease in the body. And then started piecing all of them together and little bits and pieces from folks, but I never really sat with a mentor.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you might, you know, oftentimes people who come up with systems on their own end up being the ones to write a book and create a modality that's unique in and of itself. So perhaps there's something like that coming out of you eventually, if not already. And if people are curious to learn about that from you, how might they get in touch with you?
My website for my practice is gentleneedling.com, like putting the needles in gently. Mm-hmm. The actual website's mountainspiritacupuncture.com, but I got tired of spelling acupuncture for everyone. So gentleneedling.com gets you where you need to be. That has all my contact info on it.
Okay. And so do you work mostly in person, or do you offer anything online usually?
It's all in person at this point in time. I do have a couple of clients that have moved away, and I'll do some distance counseling and distance treatment with them. But I'm not really set up to do that on a regular basis because I am a dad of three very busy kids. When I'm not in clinic treating folks, I need to focus on being a dad.
Okay. So you're located in where?
Westminster, Colorado, which is Northwest Denver, Metro Denver area.
Okay, great. So listeners can know that if they're going to be in that area or are in that area, that they can find you and reach out to you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. And listeners also know that if you'd like to learn more about the Womb Centered Healing Temple, you can go to wombcenteredhealing.com. If you want to receive notifications about future episodes of this podcast, as well as the blog and other online courses and events that might be coming up, you can subscribe to the newsletter there at wombcenteredhealing.com. And please like this video, subscribe to this channel, subscribe to this podcast, wherever you're accessing this information, if you like it, to support us continuing to create this wonderful podcast. All right. Thanks so much. That's all for now. Until next time.